You're listening to the Fooled by the Root podcast.
I'm so glad you're here to listen to this really powerful episode. This is an anonymous interview with Andy. He speaks to the pain of adoption and how it can cascade through our lives. So many adopted people are suffering, incarcerated, homeless, aching with mental health and relationship issues. Andy speaks of his self-preservation, his self-destruction, and how he struggles to find emotional safety. He takes us through the darkest, most potent pain toward the light of redemption. His mission is to speak his truth and share the rawness of his pain so that our adoption community brothers and sisters can feel validated, and also so that society can be more aware of the pain that adoption causes. Andy has had a very traumatic life, but his heart is filled with compassion and hope. He has found a sister and an amazing therapist who are helping him heal. This episode is graphic, containing detailed descriptions of physical violence, suicide, sexual, and physical abuse. To try to describe how this episode impacted me is really difficult to put into words. Andy's willingness to be vulnerable, his unflinching desire to tell his story, were heartbreaking and heart-healing. Hello, everyone. This is your host, Heidi Marble. Oh, my goodness. I am so happy to have an anonymous interview with Andy today. Andy reached out to me on our submission form on our website, and this is what he said. Only one person has ever asked him what his experience has been. His biological parents kept their first child, gave up their second, kept their third, and then gave Andy up. The two children that were given up reunited 5 years ago and are inseparable. And he has also been secondarily rejected by his biological family. So before we jump in, Andy, I just want to tell you that our interactions over the last few weeks have been really meaningful to me. You are very, very brave to share your story, and I just want to thank you in advance for the courage. When I asked you what you wanted your anonymous name to be, you didn't even hesitate. You said Andy. So maybe tell us a little bit about why that name for this interview.
Yeah, sure. It comes from a reference from the movie, The Shawshank Redemption. And the main character, Andy Dufresne, is wrongfully imprisoned, and he spends a couple decades in there. And to the quotes, when he finally breaks out, you know, it's his own doing that gets him out of there, which also I felt I could relate with. But the two quotes from him, and this is why I chose this name, it says, "Whatever mistakes I've made, I've paid for them, and then some." And then also, whenever he broke out, he chose this place on the Mexican coast, on the Pacific. And when he was talking to his friend who he wanted to meet him down there, he said, "You know what the Mexicans say about the Pacific? They say it has no memory. That's where I want to live the rest of my life. A warm place with no memory."
Oh, Andy, I want to hug you. I hate Zoom right now. Come here.
I may cry a few times during this, just because I've entered this kind of emotional and aware space that I could get to, but a lot of times I choose not to be there, you know. But it's pretty emotional looking back into this stuff I'm going to be describing.
So. I know, Andy, and I'm here to support you. If you need any breaks, you just let me know. Absolutely 100% here to support you. Well, I have these incredible pictures you sent of me, and I see your beautiful dog. And before we dive into our, you know, your story, let's talk a little bit about your... You had said that you built a life that protects you against people. You don't like or trust humans.
And I so understand that. And my dogs have been, my dogs have been so important to me too. So can you tell us just a little bit? I have this beautiful picture of you walking on the beach with your dog. What does your dog mean to you? And what, you know,
yeah, she's right here.
Can she bring? Oh no. Oh my gosh. She's beautiful. But she's so relaxed.
Oh yeah. So she's like, my sidekick, I guess. I qualify for a PTSD dog. You know, I meet the requirements, but it would have taken a couple years to get one. And I didn't want to wait. And I've always loved American Bulldogs. And she's got she's a mix of American Bulldog and American Bully. So, you know, they're under the umbrella of Pitbull, you know, but she has that unconditional love, and absolute trust. And, it's like her devotion to me makes me feel protected. I mean, she sleeps with me. She goes to the store with me everywhere I go. And you know, if I have to go into a store that doesn't allow it, that's okay. I just, you know, leave her in the car for a few minutes. I mean, she goes everywhere with me. So, she's, I don't know, I feel like, in some ways, like connected to my soul, kind of like an avatar, you know, like when they find that one dragon that they ride, they have that deep connection. And she makes me feel safer when I'm walking around, you know, outside and everything, and just knowing she's there. And when I'm sick, or when I'm having a really bad day where I don't want to get out of bed, she won't leave my side. Even you know, my sister will be like, she needs to eat, you know, and I have to like force myself to get up to make her feel that it's okay to go eat, you know. So it's that level of love and devotion that, you know, I can't live without. It's like a part of how I can function.
I think that's so important for people to know the power of having an amazing pet to connect with and the kind of love they give. So Andy, let's go there. Let's talk about your story. People really need to understand what you've been through and what you've overcome, what you've survived, and really how you've done it. And I'd just like you to share from the place that you feel the most comfortable. So you can start wherever you like.
And so to preface, you know, where we're about to go, it's...
I'm with you, Andy.
I've had an extremely traumatic life. And there's this part of me that can never be broken and never be conquered. And that same part also has like this depth of empathy and love for other people. And so I think it is that combination that allowed me to make it. And I almost didn't. So the universe also at the right time changed the direction of things. And in some ways, I'm grateful for the experience, because it's created this awareness and empathy I feel for other people that I wouldn't have been able to reach if I hadn't experienced what I did. So so I guess you want me just kind of talk about what happened?
Whatever you're comfortable with, Andy, because, you know, the last thing I want to do is re-injure you or hurt you.
That's just the whole reason I'm even doing this, is because I want people to, if they're adoptees, I'm hoping that they can relate with any part of my experience, even if the details and circumstances were different. There's certain soul elements, because pain is pain and trauma is trauma. And so I'm hoping to to use this in a way that's helpful to my brothers and sisters that are adoptees out there, and to help in whatever way, if it may heal them or they feel validation in their experience. And then also my other purpose, I really want society to take a look at adoption trauma. It's one of the most severe traumas that can happen to a human. And even people who aren't aware of it, it's because of their own defense mechanisms, which they needed to enact in order to survive. And so, and also having been gaslighted by society for so long, you know, it's that thing we call the fog, because it's my true belief, 100%, all the way down to like the core of my being in my cells, that no adoptee escapes this trauma. They don't.
They don't.
And society needs to completely reorient itself to the concept of adoption. And, you know, anything down the line regarding like the adoption industry and all that other stuff will just naturally change if individuals can all of a sudden come out of the fog, you know, all the people who aren't adopted but that are invested in it. And so that's my great hope, and that's why I want to share everything that I can about my pain, because it gives it purpose. And
yes, it does.
You know, it absolutely needs to be like the concept of adoption, the way it is in our understanding as a society, absolutely needs to change. So that's
no question, this. Andy. That's why I'm gonna do. No, and you know, it's interesting. I don't know if this will resonate with you, Andy, but I was trying to explain it to someone yesterday. I said, you know, I love myself a good steak, a beautiful filet mignon. But if you showed me the cow and how it happened and what it had to go through, it wouldn't taste so good. And I kind of feel, I'm not trying to be a vegetarian, not that I'm against it, but I was just trying to be able to, it's so hard to make people understand that adoption is not that filet mignon. There is a whole hell of a lot of pain that had to come for this baby to be in front of you. And I think we want to go to the store and only see the package and not have to believe that there was a living, breathing something. I don't know if that helps, but
I mean, it's a really good analogy.
Because so this is like revealing the pain, Andy, you know, this is showing them, this is what's the scenes. Hello. Yeah,
absolutely. So, I guess I'll just launch into my story. Like I sent in that message the way I reached out to you, my origin story, you know, now I know what it is now. I didn't know, of course, you know, so I guess I kind of want to start from my experience. My first memory was looking up and seeing my dad's face over the edge of the pool and wondering why it was so blurry. I couldn't understand why his face was so blurry. And I asked him about it a couple years ago, and he's like, how do you even remember that? You know, you're like two and you fell into the pool. And I want to describe this because it's so important, especially if everybody's or anybody who's listening, I hope they read The Primal Wound. Because when the child is born, it is instantly, when it's separated from its mother, it doesn't even know that it's a separate being, first of all. It's very confusing in that when they get individualized, it's a process. It takes a long time, and it needs that mother's familiarity, because you know the sounds, the heartbeat, the smells. It's like everything is instinctually familiar, and so when that's ripped, the infant has a complete soul-shattering experience, because it knows it's not safe. Something's wrong. And that feeling of not being safe was kind of integrated into me. But like in my early childhood, my mom described how, you know, those little walkers you run in, she left the door open, and I ran down went through the door to the basement and bounced down the stairs and cracked my head open on concrete. And not long after that, they left the front door open, and I wandered down a hill to this tennis court. You know, it took them like an hour and a half or something to find me. And then my dad was driving a bulldozer. And these are like common. These are like any kid growing up. You know, this is common, right? Like my dad was driving a bulldozer. I bounced out of his lap and landed on the track and almost got run over. And they tell these stories with humor because they're reflecting on them. You know, I made it through, but reflecting back as a child, these, even though I don't remember some of these, I do remember the pool. It reinforced that idea that I'm not safe. Other kids where these natural accident type things can happen to, they can return to their mother. That's a natural thing, not just another caregiver, but like that soul connection, and they can be comforted through any type of accidents or mishaps that a parent may do, because none of us are perfect parents. But so that was reinforced in this is where I want to talk about the motives of adoption. The people who have a strong desire to adopt, almost for the vast majority, it's due to some longing within inside them. It's not for the, I mean, they may try to rationalize it as a rescuing of a child, but it's for, like, you know, if they can't have their own biological child, or societal pressures, these people that seek out someone else's child, the very thing that draws them in connection with the very thing that, whatever may be the forces that are causing the relinquishment, there's a transaction made, and it's a transaction in darkness and in shame. And a lot of the, you know, instead of funneling all this money, because there's a lot of money, people will pay a lot of money to adopt a child, instead of like, why aren't we funneling money to keep a child with its mother, you know? And we're always in a zeitgeist. Like it used to be, you know, the shame in being an unwed mother in Catholicism. You gotta, you know, so there's these outward pressures that are pushing the mother to relinquish. So whatever the reason may be, it's an unnatural event. And the very people who are drawn to adopt, even though they can be the best people in the world, that root thing that makes them go reach for that child is what's going to punish that child, because they haven't done their own inner work. Mm-hmm. And that child is now not a human. It's a role. It's an idea. My own parents took me to get checked out by a doctor. And they joke about it, you know, like we wanted to make sure that you're healthy, you know, because we didn't want a functional piece of equipment, basically, you know. And it shows it right there. Like, if it was about the child, or me in this case, it wouldn't matter what defects I came with. It would be about loving it, you know, but there's this transactional quality, and it's undeniable. So my mother, and I want to say now, as adoptees, we all have this, like, I love my parents. I'm not trying, you know, and we try to like have this fine print read before we can speak our truth. You know, my mother was a very traumatized person herself. And her grandfather, or her father, my grandfather, was abusive, and he had been traumatized. So it's this cycle of trauma. Okay. And I absolutely love my mother. This is the best relationship I've ever had with her. But due to her not doing her work and being a traumatized person, she has obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which is very different than OCD. It has to do with control. They make lists. Like whenever my mother speaks to my kids, she has to, on FaceTime, my kids are, you know, young. Like I have a 17-year-old and a 14-year-old and 10-year-old. Whenever she speaks to them, she writes up a list of interview questions because she can't just naturally be organic, you know? And due to her own trauma, she has this intense, like, uncontrollable urge to control. And so you combine that with, like, you know, they were trying to have a child. They had my brother, but then she had to have a hysterectomy because of all the drugs that, you know, they were trying to give her to get pregnant again. But the idea of like her idea of the list of what it means to have a family is two children. And so they went and, you know, adopted. She failed, I think it was three home study psych evals. And so she changed her trajectory and started contacting pediatricians, you know. So this closed adoption through a pediatrician kind of circumvented that. I mean, it was a loophole. And when I was a child, I needed that. I was just happy inside, like trying to be a happy-go-lucky kid who just needed love. And my mom could not provide what it was actually quite the opposite. And so anytime I should get frustrated because she wasn't meant to be a parent in a way, like she was due to her trauma. And she started abusing me out of frustration. First it would be like, go to your room and dragging me down the hall by my arm in a painful way. But then the older I got, it became abuse. She would, anytime that I would do something that would break the idea of the list kind of thing, she would hit me with pots and pans or whatever was around. And the thing inside me that refused to be conquered, it's all of a sudden, instead of like trying to meet my own needs, or I wouldn't give in to meeting the ones that were being demanded of me as far as other people's, it was like the whole fact that I was put in that situation, the thing that wouldn't be destroyed in me chose to fight an honorable fight. And so I would stand there defiant while I'd be abused, and that would increase her frustration. And, you know, but it went all the way up till I was about, I think I was 16. And I got so good at blocking punches and stuff that she just couldn't do it anymore, you know? And it would enrage her, but she couldn't get that control. And so I picked her up, I threw her into a wall, and she, that was the only time I laid my hands on her. Because I adamantly will not want to hurt another human being, if at all possible. And so when she hit the wall and slid down, my dad had witnessed it, and he raised his hand like he was going to hit me. And I said, if you fucking hit me, I'm going to kill you. And he could tell he could tell I was 100%, you know. And so that was last time I was physically abused. But they started taking away my housing, you know. And so I was an angry teenager. I was angry. I was so angry. And it was during that time period where there was this big push for, you know, teenagers, if they're angry, they're doing drugs and all that kind of thing. And he has to get in treatment. So and I had done marijuana like 5 times, you know, and I think I'd done mushrooms twice. And they had decided that my anger was because I had a drug problem. And so they drug tested me, which, you know, just bad timing. You know, I'd only smoked weed like 5 times, maybe 6, because it made me paranoid. It makes me so paranoid. I don't even do it when it's legal. You know, it makes me so paranoid. But so they sent me to this outpatient treatment center, and it changed my life. This lady who they put their trust in, and my parents are good people. They like their heart. If you just judge their heart, they're good intentions. They're good people. It's just my the abuse that happened was due to my mom's trauma and her frustration and tolerance, and she would fly into a rage, you know. So it's like, but she's a good person. She really is. And so my parents put their trust in this this lady who ran her own little outpatient treatment center. And I got assessed by this lady, and I told her I'd only smoked weed like, you know, 5 or 6 times. And she said, "You're lying. Yeah, that's a drug addict behavior." She'd already decided that, you know, I was a druggie in that. And so she told me, "You're lying. And unless you tell me the truth, I'm going to have your parents send you to an inpatient treatment center for 3 months. And then a halfway house after." And I'm scared. You know, it's like I had my group of friends is stressful as my life was at home. It was familiar. I was scared. I didn't have any life skills, you know, to just the idea of being sent away. You know, I was like, I was scared. And so I made in that decision a self-preservation choice to either like to what do I have to tell her to meet the minimum requirement of not being sent to this place. And so I kept trying to add a little bit, but then that's exactly what she wanted, because now that was just proof that I'd been a liar, you know? So anyway, long story short, I ended up homeless, and the agreement was my parents would take me back if I went to this inpatient treatment center after I'd done a couple years at this outpatient place. So I was couch hopping. I was sleeping on the street. I came from a affluent family but they were super frugal with money, you know? So I was like raised like a poor kid in a rich family, you know? So I had no life skills, and I learned really quick that, anyway, I didn't want to live like that. And so I'm like, fine, screw it. I'll go to treatment. And actually, the treatment center for that 3 months, I had a really good time. But then, because now I was caught in this lie of I couldn't, no one ever believed me when I told them how much drugs I had done. It was like this lie now took on. Even when I tried to correct it, they're like, "Oh, you're lying. You're addict. That's proof that you're an addict and that you're in relapse behavior." So I could no longer ever tell the truth, you know. So this is where things get bad. That treatment center told my parents that I needed to go to a whole different state, is to Louisiana, to go to this halfway house, that I could never recover if I was around my friends. And so my parents put their trust in the recommendation. They said, "If you don't go, you're going to be on the street, you know?" Well, I'm like, okay, I got to go. And that when I talk to the people on the phone at this halfway house, they're like, yeah, we got a pool, we got a ping pong table, we got all, you know, all kinds of stuff, video games, you know. I'm like, well, here we go. I have to, you know. When I got down there, they lied to me. And I remember driving from New Orleans to this place kind of by Baton Rouge, totally foreign. It seemed like driving through the swamps and just like, where is my dad taking me to abandon me? You know? And when I got there, it was the most hostile environment. There's no way to describe it. They did a lot of illegal things. They put me on food restrictions or I couldn't eat for a week. I tried to call my parents and tell them what was happening. And they convinced my parents I was just lying and doing addict behavior stuff. They would do these things like, you know, where you take like a glove and you run it along like a windowsill. And if there's any dust, they would call it a confo. I don't even understand their terminology, but if you got five of them, then you got put on what they call personal flats, where you couldn't sing, couldn't whistle, couldn't read, couldn't do anything. And anytime for that year and a half I was there, if I wanted to speak before, even if I had to say, hey, I got to use the bathroom, I had to do this ritual where I had to jump up and down and say, my name is Andy, I'm a king baby, and I cry if I don't get what I want. And so anytime I had to speak, so I stopped wanting to talk, you know. And when enough of us, there were 30 of us there, when enough of us got put on personal flats, then we got put on what they call community flats, where every single one of us had to be within 3 feet of each other at all times. If somebody was taking, you know, using the bathroom, the other 29 of us grown men had to be on the other side of that door. We spent quite a few months like that, and we would get into fist fights. And a lot of these guys were there from prison that were trying to get a few years taken off their sentence. So the people in charge would take bets on who would win fights. It became a dog eat dog thing, man. And eventually there was this girl who had been coming to tutor. The youngest kid there was 17, and he was going to local high school during the day, and he was having a hard time in math. So this girl would come and tutor him. And I could tell she kind of had a little crush on me, you know? And I called my parents to say, I got to get out of this place. Of course, the leader denied anything that was happening and said I was an addict. And so my parents stopped taking my phone calls. And so when I'm like, I have to leave, the leader, who had spent, I think it was like 15 years in Rikers prison, and he's a big guy. Whenever he yelled, it was scary. You know, people, he had a frightening presence, and he always reminded us about how he would be gang raped in prison, you know? And so he told me, if you leave here, I'm going to call with the connections I have around here in this town, I'm going to say that we're going to make up a felony, and you're going to get arrested for a felony, and you're going to spend the rest of your life in Angola getting raped. And it scared me because I saw that they had done a couple of things, not to that extent where somebody got arrested and went to prison, but where people did get arrested. But anyway, after living in that, I'm like, you know what? Screw it. I'm not going to, if you can do that, do it. And I called this girl and she came and picked me up, and it was 2 a.m. and her mom, thank goodness she had her own issues. She's like, hey, you can live with us. And that was the first time I actually felt somewhat safe. This girl was so good to me. But I mean, I was kind of broken. I treated her well for a few years, but then I ended up cheating on her, and rightfully, you know, that ended. So that was one period in my life, and I'm still friends with her, and I'm so grateful for her. But then, long story short, I I spent my parents would never help me out. I had to learn how to fend for myself. I used charm and I just wanted to be loved, you know? And so I would try to meet my needs of getting shelter by using charm. And I was just so, I hated the universe. It was so unfair and so unjust, but that part of me wouldn't die, you know? But I ended up marrying a woman down there, and we had a son together. And when I saw him for the first time, I'm like, wow, this is my blood. And I said, it's you and me, kiddo. You and me, we're gonna make it, you know? His mother ended up drinking and driving and killing someone. She's...
Oh, Andy. No.
I blame myself for that. And I know I carry a portion because I wasn't the best husband. I wasn't physically abusive, but I wasn't faithful. And I was a mess, man. And anyway, and she's a good woman. She really is. She's got a lot of her own issues. She's like one of those luminescent souls, you know? And it was just so horrible that this happened. And so I blame myself. And her entire family, Cajun culture, there is no worse place for an adopted adult than to be married into somebody in the Cajun culture, because they have like 10,000 family that rally around each other, and you are the odd man out, you know? Well, they blame me for that, and I blame myself. So at the time, it kind of went hand in hand, but, we'd gotten a divorce, and I married another person. We had two children together, but there were periods now I was so unhappy. And the second wife, her mother was so emotionally and psychologically abusive to me. She screamed at me in front of my kids how I was a horrible father and was going to hell, and what a horrible human I was, an embarrassment to their family because I have piercings. And because I have tattoos. And I wasn't allowed back into her house until I took out my LeBray, and I'm like, gave them the middle finger. I'm like, I'm not fine. You know, I'm not coming back in your house. But like, I was living in this small little town, little rural Cajun town, a couple hours from anywhere important. And I was so isolated. Plus, I was doing social work at the time. And I was working in a hospital where anytime anybody was dying, I got called in, to be there in case family would show up or whatever. I've seen so many people die and been there when they took their last breath. Anytime there was abuse and neglect, I had to respond to the emergency room when I saw kids killed. There was one. And so anyway, this is all going on while I didn't feel safe, emotionally safe at home. And there was this one instance that really triggered all my adoption trauma, where this mother had left her baby when he was 18 months old with her boyfriend, and he covered him in boiling water. And when he was brought to the ER, he looked like what I imagine, like a Hiroshima victim, like a lot of his skin is sloughed off. And they couldn't stop him screaming because they couldn't get a vein, because it was mush. His muscles were mush, you know. She was standing at the head of the bed with just this flat affect. And that shook my universe. That was like, I couldn't even be around my own infant when I went home when she cried. I couldn't be around it. Anyway, I wanted to die. I wanted to die. And I attempted suicide. And I have no idea how I ended up making it, but I was in ICU. I'd overdosed and I'd taken like 1,000 different pills, blood pressure medication, everything, because I wanted to die. When I woke up in ICU, I was alone. And I asked who would come to see me. Nobody. Not even my parents. Nobody. And I'd been there a week. And I'm like, something has to change, you know? So basically, as much as I love my kids, I felt like they would be better off without me because they're surrounded by like a loving family, at least, even though the family was harsh to me. And I just wanted to die. And anytime I try to whiten up it through and ate them, I ended up getting hospitalized at psych units, even when I asked for help, you know, and anytime I asked for help, like, man, I'm having suicidal thoughts, my life would get worse. I'd come out. So one time when I went in there, when I came out, my son had been sent to live with his mom and enrolled in a new school when his mom finally got out of prison. And so my son was gone. My wife had filed for divorce, and it's understandable completely. I'm not like, I wouldn't have wanted to been married to me either. I was a mess, you know, but like my support was gone. I had no support. And then I wouldn't have a car so that I'd lose my job. And so I'd end up homeless quite a few times. And it got to the point, I know I got to probably wrap this up. It got to the point where I was like, life, you either got to do something now or I'm like, no joke, man, I'm done. And my whole idea of like, if this is how life is in the universe, like I'm hoping for blackness. I hope that there's nothing. I hope, because holy shit, if it's this bad already, what's it going to be like after I die? I'm not Christian. I'm not, I don't believe in any kind of organized religions description of God, but I was like, man, this is bad. Like, there's no way out of this. And that's what, and so I had this conversation. I said, life, you freaking owe me. You owe me, and it's time to cash in. And I came up back to my home state, came back to Oregon, and another friend who was adopted and who is on his way down in a spiral. I mean, he's lost it now. But at the time, he could put me up for a couple months. I finally turned in my adoption papers to find out, like, you know, I pay money for it. And my dad charged me, like, because I couldn't afford it at the time. So he put it on, like, IOU, you know, $35 for trying to find out who my family is. And this whole time I had always like held my birth mother to some kind of like on a pedestal, you know? And, but some part of me was like, she threw me into this void. There's no reason that can, I could not imagine what fair trade that would have been for everything I went through. But I loved her. I had this immense desire to know her, but I had gotten my paper notarized like 5 different times. And I was always afraid to turn it in because I didn't want to be rejected. And so finally I did, because I'm at this, like, you know, I'd rather be dead than anything else, you know, so why not? And, I got this call from the adoption person that Oregon has, and she said, almost instantly, like, you know, she's like, hey, is this Douglas Freeman? Yeah, you know, this is the adoption, whatever the term was for her position. But she's like, well, I have found your family and your mother's dead. And after that, it was like hard to hear anything else, you know, like this, just this, I felt like I had like a javelin thrown through my heart, you know? And Mayway, she's like, your father's alive. You know, you got two brothers and you have a sister. And your sister put her information in here because like 20 years prior, she had done her own search and she left the information. And so that lady put us in touch. And my sister was the answer from the universe. Like, God, I can't even. The misery that I had lived through, it was like if the black hole sucks somebody in and there's like a white hole of, like on the other side, it's like she was worth it. She was worth that unbearable pain. She was worth it. I'm not saying my kids weren't worth it. It's because there's like a dynamic of like, I'm not emotionally dependent on my kids. You know, it's like, I'm supposed to be their protector. I'm supposed to be their teacher. And I love them. Like, I love them with my whole soul. So but this dynamic, it's different. It's someone else from the same family who had experienced her own hell. And oh my God, like the connection is like, I don't even know how to describe that type of connection of like, there was a movie that did. It was The Other Side of the Mountain or The Far Side of the Mountain with Idris Elba and I forget who else, but they were in a plane wreck together and they experienced all this trauma. And then at the end, it showed them, and theirs was like a romantic relationship, but like the intimacy, that the strong connection, it showed because like everybody else was like blurred and they lived through all that. And so they were like in this separate little space, you know? And yeah, come to find out my birth father is like one of the worst humans you can imagine. Just for an example, when my sister reunited with him and gave him a picture of her, and then she ended up basically cutting off contact for 20 years, he told girlfriends he'd bring home that picture was his dead wife. That was his daughter. And this guy, anyway, but he can be fun. He's fun to be around when he's not being weird, you know, like he's so funny. He's a great storyteller. I mean, he'll just have me in tears laughing. And I wanted that with him. But initially he denied me. He said that I didn't even exist. He told my brothers, who now I reunited with, that I was a scam artist trying to get money. And they're like, Dad, we don't have any money. And he looks just like you. I found him on Facebook. Like, I had no way to get a hold of him, but I found him through Facebook Messenger. You know, I sent him my very first book. Yeah. My biological father was, I'm going to bleep this out, but I'm your effing son, you effing prick. And
yeah, exactly.
He never responded, but eventually he finally, we did reunite. And then he tried to act like I was the best thing in the world. And then I can only handle him in doses because he's just the epitome of a perpetual liar, you know, and he's just so selfish and narcissistic. But my sister got breast cancer. And I'm so glad I was there for her because I'm basically functionally disabled, and I'll give an example in a second. But I confronted our biological father for not reaching out to her like 6 months into chemo, you know? I'm like, dude, what the hell is wrong with you, you know? And I did it in kind of an angry way, you know, but he told me, he's writing me out of his life that no one ever talks to him that way. And I'm like, F you, you know? Like, so I haven't heard from him since. That was it. And anyway, so that was hard, that secondary rejection, but at least it was on defense of my own sister. And
yes.
But I'm functionally disabled. I'm in the process of trying to, you know, I have an attorney who's been working on, you know, because I've never been able to keep a job for more than, I think 2 years was the longest, but from having complex PTSD from everything I've been through. And also, oh yeah, I have PTSD on top of that from like, I was almost executed in a robbery. I've been shot at. I've been beat up by gangs. I've had, so anyway, and now anytime my life is threatened, like, first of all, anywhere I go, I'm looking. Like when I'm in the grocery store, I'm scanning everywhere for anybody to be, every human is a threat to me, potential threat, you know? And so I can't relax when I'm out. I can't sit with my back to a door. I have to strategically place myself in restaurants when prior to COVID. COVID's actually made my life a lot better in a lot of ways. But I see everything as a threat. And even though I've done so much emotional work, I'm in therapy twice a week. I love life now. I love life. It's so precious to me that it actually enhances me seeing everything as a threat, because I'll be damned if anything they try to take it away from me, you know? And so I limit interactions with people. I have virtually no social life aside from doing things with my sister and her family and my family. I have a couple really good friends. Or not a couple. I got a handful. I've got a few on the East Coast, a few down south, and a few here. And I, out of all my mistakes, I picked the most amazing friends. Like, my God, I'm like the most blessed man on earth when it comes to friends. And anyway, but I'll give you an example of how I can't function in a society. When I was driving for Uber and Lyft, which was really hard for me to do because I hate having people behind me. I was in between rides, and I was about a half mile away from my house. And this homeless dude, I had the windows open. He leaned into the window and, you know, kind of put his arms in the window. And he said, "Hey, man, you got any money?" And I'm like, I'm sorry. I don't, you know. And he said, "You're not sorry, but you will be." And instantly, this is this weird depersonalization, fight or flight thing that is ingrained in who I am now, because I grew up under this kind of thing. When I feel threatened, either emotionally or like my life is threatened, I enter the space. And it's with PTSD, of course, like it's like lizard brain, you know, my heart rate goes up, everything else, but I also, I think very tactically, and it's this cold place to where, like, if I saw somebody murder right in front of me, it wouldn't faze me. And it's a temporary suspension of emotion so I can function. But what's scary is I will act as if things are a threat to my life when I'm in that space. And this guy, I tried to ignore him. I drove away, you know. I kept missing exits and everything. I got clock out. I can't do the rides. So a couple hours later, I'm like, I got to confront this guy. I went back. I found him. He was a couple blocks away, and he was sleeping in this recliner. It's like nasty old recliner. you know, against the building. And I walked up. I'm like, hey, man. And he was scared. Nancy woke up. He was scared. And I said, look, I too have been in your position. And I am sorry. It's horrible, man. I have barely enough to even survive on my own. I'm dependent on other people, and that's not even enough. And I said, you threatened my life. If it comes in, and I'm not far from my house, you know, and so I know if you're tracking things, you know who I am, or my car, you'll run across it, and I can't have that. So if this is it, in, if, you know, I didn't mention my sister, but I was thinking he could kill my sister or something, you know? So I told him, if we have to do life or death right now and one of us walks away, let's do it. And the guy got scared. Luckily, you know, like otherwise I would be in prison for murder. But that's the space I get in. And when I walked away from that, when he totally like, I mean, he's very convincing that he wanted nothing to do with that, you know? So, when I walked away, I couldn't get out of that space. And I recognized something's not right. You know, like the threat's gone and here I am, I'm in it. And, anyway, so I'm working on it. And, but I, right now I'm like, I try to limit my interactions with people. I'm very, very protective of the people I love and my life, as far as like, I have so much to live for now. I don't want to risk it. And I have had so much horrible, like my life be threatened, numerous times where I should have been dead by other people's hands and my own that like, I still see the world as this extremely dangerous place. But that one part of me has this love and compassion for people. And that's why I want to do this. Because and I find what you do, Heidi, you have this gift of, you show how safe that connection is to other people. Like, you create instant safety. And that to me is like, how in the world can you have existed and still have that? Like, it's amazing. And I think what you're doing is amazing. Our brothers and sisters out there, their trauma may not have had the same details as mine or been in the details themselves. Like, that's all it is. We share the same trauma, all of us. In adoption, and I have the most beautiful relationship that I've ever had with my adoptive parents. Like, it's wonderful. And I have compassion and empathy on my mother. I don't want her to feel that insecure and that so desperately needing control, because she's so vulnerable and has been so hurt. So it's like, I want to embrace them, you know? And, but with people, I have that same feeling that holy crap, when I go out there, oh my God, I see how time flying. But this is where I want to put this one thing. There's this special place that I've heard other people do with reaching their inner child. You know, I have this this image, and it's not just an image; it's like a real moving parts, like more than a movie. It's like inside my brain, there's this living thing, and I walked down that hallway in that house where the abuse started. And I walked all the way down to the end to where my room is. And I see myself sitting on the floor just quiet and scared and just wanting love, you know? And the beauty of like the sunlight and everything I can see out the window, it almost magnifies it, like how wrong it is, you know? Like how on 9/11, it was such a beautiful day. People remember that because the contrast, you know? And I walk and I see myself. And what's weird is like, I'm staring out of my own, who I am now, but I'm wearing like this gladiator outfit. And I can't pick that kid up. I can't touch him. And I just got to say, you know what? In my head, and maybe one day it'll change, but where I'm at is like, in order for me to even be standing here right now in this armor to where I can protect us, you got to go through all that shit. Because in some ways, that's the only thing that helps me have protection around what I have now, you know? And even though I didn't deserve it, like, that's how I'm oriented now. So I got my dog, I got my sister, I got my family, my kids, and man, that's all I want. And my therapist, I gotta tell you, I'm actually resentful of the boundary because I want him in my life. He's helped me so much, you know, but right now he's just got to exist like a force ghost. But anyway, I'm so grateful for you, Heidi, and for this opportunity, because not one single person ever asked me until I was like, I went with my sister to do the, like, what do you call it? Like the legal thing. Cause we're not legally related. Like in the eyes of the law, we're like not, you know? And so if something were to happen to me, you know, if I want breathing tube or all that other stuff, you know, so that last will kind of thing. We went to the attorney, and the attorney, you know, asked about how we're related or whatever. And we gave her the quickest rundown ever, you know, but she looked at me, she's just like, what was that like for you? I was like, holy shit. I've never been asked that question ever. And that wasn't a place to really describe it, you know, but the very transaction of adoption silences us. It gags us. We're gagged and chained, and then we're separated from each other. We don't have a community, and until we seek it out, we're not like, we're isolated. And this whole thing is we're alone. Until now, we're coming out and being like, this is not right, man. This is not right. And what you're doing, I think, is one of the most beautiful things in the universe, Heidi. It's so powerful because it's healing to us, and it's educating, because there's no denying it. And the thing we're screaming into, this void of like willful ignorance, and there's so much invested in people's emotions to have a silence. You're putting like the biggest magnified loudspeaker right into that. And there's a bunch of podcasts doing it, but it's like we who have never had a voice finally have one. And thank you, because it's, oh my God, it's like, it's so important. I feel like the universe really, really needs you to do what you're doing, you know? And so anyway.
Andy. I just need you to come hug me.
Yeah, I really would if I could, you know.
I know you would. Andy, this has been Sorry, I'm having trouble composing myself. First of all, people can't see you, but you are just this big, tough-looking guy. And if I saw you on the street, I'd probably be afraid of you. But what you just did, the vulnerability, the honesty, you like unzipped your soul. And that is so brave. Like, I have witnessed bravery. I witnessed bravery, a lot of it, Andy, but nothing like this. This is in another category. And what you said to me means so much because this work is painful and it's hard. But we have to walk through the fire. And we have to do it together. And we have to be each other's brothers and sisters. And we have to take our brothers and sisters out of isolation. And I just know that this episode is going to be such a place for people to feel the gravity, come to terms and to access it, and to give it space to breathe. And in that space, we become powerful. Oh, Andy, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be connected to you, and you are my brother. You are my brother. And I'm proud of you and the healing that you're creating for yourself. And I just hope that you'll come back and that we can continue to share space together. And I hope one day to meet you. We're not that far away.
Yeah. I would love all of that.
Thank you, Andy.